From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. While the world watched Iraq, the crackdown began just 90 miles from Florida, like scenes played out in another decade and a colder war. Fidel Castro's regime in Cuba came down hard on democratic reformers, even trooped out a firing squad. The apparent message, don't even dream about a velvet revolution here. Tonight on Point, Castro's stunning crackdown and the new struggle for Cuba. We begin with new sounds from Baghdad. The ouster of Saddam Hussein has left the city with a terrifying power vacuum, and in some quarters, Shiite Muslim clerics are stepping into the void. Anthony Shadid is a correspondent for The Washington Post in Baghdad. I asked him how the city is taking to the gun-toting clerics.
I think across Baghdad, you're seeing a vacuum of authority. Saddam Hussein's government, after three decades of rule, basically collapsed overnight. And in that void, you've seen forces emerging almost immediately from the grassroots to fill the vacuum. And among the first are the Shiite Muslim clergy that are in Baghdad. They're one of the few forces in the country that haven't been shattered by Ba'ath Party rule. And they're quickly seizing the moment. They're trying to create a force that will make them a group to be reckoned with in the deliberations that go on for weeks and months over a new government in Iraq. In Saddam City, which has now been renamed Sadr City after an Ayatollah who was killed by the government in 1999, the mosques have pretty much set up kind of a government in waiting. They're an authority that is at least respected by the people that live among them.
Anthony, you describe a Shiite cleric with a pistol on each hip leading prayers at the Prophet Muhammad Mosque and saying, we order people to obey us. When we say stand up, they stand up. When we say sit down, they sit down. Are these clerics in a position to really move in and be the new sheriff in town, the new boss?
Well, I think it's a drama that's going to be really interesting to watch over the next few months. The Shiite clergy is very hierarchical, and they do pay respect to the clergy that is based in Najaf, one of the holiest cities in Iraq. But I think there is a question whether that authority is going to be passed down to the street level. And what you see in Sadr City today is some religious leaders seeming to almost stake out their own territory, their own turf. The one cleric that you mentioned had basically an armed guard, and he was followed by a contingent of guys carrying Kalashnikovs as he toured hospitals, as he visited checkpoints. You did get kind of a martial sense of what was going on there, and the question did immediately arise, would he answer orders if that meant into his authority? I think that's going to be a question that people need to watch over the coming months. There do seem to be power struggles along a lot of different fissures in Iraqi society, not only between Shiites and Sunnis, for instance, or between Arabs and Kurds, but also within the Shiite community itself, between exiles and the people that have been here throughout the Ba'ath Party rule. And I think within those fissures, we're really going to see how this country is defined in the future.
And what about on the streets of Baghdad itself? Is the United States mustering a secular authority there? We understand the U.S. screened and has deployed some couple thousand Iraqi police. Are they evident? Are they making a difference in order in the city?
Well, when you talk about authority, it's a difficult question to answer because I think one of the accomplishments, and I don't say that in a positive sense, is that the Ba'ath Party over three decades has depoliticized this country to a large degree. There are a few centers of authority that still exist. It was relentless repression, and those that did take part in dissent ended up in jail or dead. So one of the few institutions of authority that you still see that's still organized is the Shiite Muslim clergy, and I think that's why they've been so quick to arise into this vacuum that was left by the government's collapse. When we speak about secular rule, really the vestiges of secular rule are within the Ba'ath Party, and I don't think the Americans are going to be too eager to engage that party in reconstituting the government. And it's going to be a question that the Americans obviously have to grapple with. They haven't at this point really shown any signs of a vision in Baghdad, at least. There have been steps to end the looting, to bring some kind of law and order. It seems in a lot of ways a stopgap measure, and I don't think you've seen them deliver this broader program of what a future Iraqi government is going to look like.
Anthony, how are the people of Baghdad processing what has happened to them over the last 3 weeks?
You know, it's a remarkable few days in Baghdad. The war was costly. There's no question about it. There is resentment over the suffering that they endured during 3 weeks of war. It was not a clean war. And I think you saw mixed in with the relief and, you know, at times jubilation over the fall of Hussein's government, you also saw relief that the war was over. There was a lawlessness. There was, you know, the question of authority. There was, when were the Americans going to respond to the need for electricity, for water? When will the phones be reconnected? The city seems almost awash in anxiety, unease over when things are going to start returning to normal. There's this very deep desire to have at least the shreds of a normal life. And we haven't seen that yet in Baghdad. I think a lot of people, when they get beyond that, when they get beyond those immediate needs, they do wonder how this drama is going to unfold. And there's a certain gratitude, toward the Americans as an instrument to end Hussein's rule, but I think there's also a certain apprehension of varying degrees. It ranges from suspicions to the resentment over what the Americans necessarily intend to do in Baghdad and Iraq in general. And I don't think they have a clear picture of that at this point.
Do you get the sense that the Americans have a clear picture of how to proceed with this big city, with this large country?
In Baghdad, at least, you don't at this point, and that might just be the case because it's only the military here, really. And the military is obviously not charged with creating a new government in Baghdad. There are reports that the more civilian authority is going to be arriving in Baghdad in future days, and I think that'll be a welcome development among a lot of Iraqis. But, you know, one of the most striking things about the scene in Baghdad today is how much diversity of opinion there is. I mean, this is a country that was, at least in public statements, monochromatic. There was little other than, you know, expressions of support for the government itself. Now you see the full spectrum of sentiments, and it ranges from, you know, resentment of what people see as an American occupation to utter relief and joy over the end of Hussein's government. So the Americans, I think, when they do arrive, they're going to step into a very tumultuous landscape, and it's going to be one very difficult to navigate. One of the things that struck me in conversations in Sadr City a few days ago was one clergyman basically saying that, you know, we're stepping in right now to create our own institutions, and we're going to be a force that the Americans are going to have to deal with once they arrive. And you almost saw them drawing the map before the map was even completed.
Anthony Shadid, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Anthony Shadid is correspondent for The Washington Post. He spoke with me from Baghdad. On the glittering beaches east of Havana, European and American tourists sip mojitos and tip in American dollars. Inside the city last week, 80 so-called mercenaries on Washington's payroll, Cuban political activists, were sentenced in lightning trials behind closed doors. 36 now sit in prison, facing up to 27 years. It's been a wild month. 4 planes and a ferryboat hijacked, 3 hijackers executed. After what looked like a slow drift toward a more tolerant Cuban state, the crackdown seemed like a shocking throwback to the tense 1960s, raising many new questions about an aging Fidel Castro's agenda and U.S.-Cuba relations. Why the big new Fidel crackdown, and why now? What's really going on behind the tourist trappings in Cuba? And why can't Cuba tolerate a little dissent, a little democracy? And I guess, where is Washington's hand in the uproar? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight from Havana is Gary Marks, Havana correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. Good evening and welcome, Gary Marks. Hi, thanks for being with us. And joining me from outside Washington is Dr. Julia Swag, Senior Fellow and Deputy Director of the Latin America Studies Program at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of Inside the Cuban Revolution. Good evening and welcome, Julia Swag.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Gary Marks, we've got a little lag in our phone line, but I want to come to you first. Please update us on what's been going on in Cuba. It's been quite a month. It really stands out in the horizon of Cuban events in the last several years. Can you just walk us through these last 3 or 4 weeks?
Well, essentially, there's been a number of just incredible events. First, you had the step up in U.S.-Cuba friction with the top U.S. diplomat here, James Kaysen, essentially going out and meeting publicly with dissidents, and actually after those meetings criticizing the Cuban government. From that point, you also had dozens of dissidents who were rounded up, arrested, and essentially sentenced to long prison terms after what were essentially summary trials. At the same time, you had several hijackings. 2 or 3 planes were hijacked. A ferry boat was hijacked by essentially individuals who were fed up with the economic situation here. And they, again, were sentenced in summary trials. And 3 of those individuals who hijacked a ferry earlier this month were executed on Friday of last week.
Gary Marks, what exactly do we know about the trials of the political activists? Where did they take place? How long did they take? Do we have any sense of what kind of evidence was given? And were the long terms they were given within the norm of usual sentences for what were they convicted of, I guess?
Well, they were essentially convicted of being agents of the U.S. government, and they were convicted of trying to essentially foment counter-revolution. And the trials occurred over several days. They were essentially closed trials. Only the family members were allowed in there. European diplomats tried to get in, and they were denied access. The prison sentence were obviously incredibly lengthy, although those of us who were down here sort of had a hint from the start that Cuba was going to throw the books at these individuals.
And do you see, can you feel, an impact in Cuba among political circles? Did they round up everybody? Are there others who were sympathetic to this group that are now chilled? Among those who were hit was the prime mover in the petition that's been circulated in Cuba asking for more representative government. Is that now dead?
I mean, Tom, I think in the short term, the dissident movement essentially has been gutted. It's been absolutely devastated by this. And, part of the reason is the Cuban government arrested some, but not all of the dissidents. Some of the top people, including Osvaldo Paya, the head of the Varela Project, and Elizardo Sanchez, who heads the major human rights organization here, they were not arrested. But that's, some people say that's part of the strategy here. You arrest some, you don't arrest others, you sow dissent, and you sow suspicion. Much of the evidence that was gathered against these individuals was presented by people, by Cuban agents who had infiltrated these organizations and worked side by side with these dissidents for years. So there is a lot of suspicion among the dissident movement. It's essentially been gutted in the short term. The question is, where will the dissident movement go from here? How much toleration will be allowed? And what the U.S. government's next move is? They have been actively supporting, over the last couple of years, these dissident groups. They have been financing independent journalists by funding websites out of Miami, by providing mm-hmm. people with fax machines and with computers and giving them access to the Internet. And that's been tolerated until recently. And the question now is, what is the U.S. government's reaction going to be? And what is the Cuban government's reaction going to be as well?
Julia Swag, I'm going to want to get your interpretation, but if you'd be good enough to first put this flurry of developments in a context for us. What's been the evolution politically within Cuba and in its relations with the U.S. that we should understand as the backdrop to what's happened here?
Well, for as long as I've been following this, and that goes back to the early 1980s, really since the mid-1980s, and I know that it goes back even farther. You could say that it goes back to the Bay of Pigs, or even preceding that. The United States has always, since it took a dislike to Castro and the crowd around him, even when he was in the opposition, and then trace it all through the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and now, has always looked for ways to gain a toehold on the island by in larger or lesser degree with more or less money, less mm-hmm. or more serious depending upon the international context and domestic politics here.
So are you saying that this dissident movement is a kind of a export from the U.S., that it's not indigenous?
It is and it is not, and I think that there's a big variety within the dissident movement in Cuba. You asked me about the context. The mm-hmm. context has been the United States has always sought mm-hmm. to support groups on the island that oppose Fidel Castro. That's nothing new. We've seen it since the Bay of Pigs.
Mm-hmm.
What is the case in terms of evolution is that really since 1996 and its aftermath, when Cuba shot down two planes and interrupted a process of quiet rapprochement that had begun under the Clinton administration, the Helms-Burton bill passed, and many of us thought that relations would be frozen for some time, but gradually an opening was created in the Congress and through the beginning of trade and travel. And at the same time, and in parallel to that, the Cuban government really did sort of take a position of sitting on its hands and holding its tongue and allowing the United States in word and in deed to support some groups and individuals on the island because I think it calculated that the medium and long-term gain outweighed the whatever weakness and vulnerability it showed by allowing this to happen, and that calculation has now changed for a variety of reasons that I can go into in the course of the discussion.
We're going to come back and look at that. We're talking about Castro's crackdown, the new struggle over Cuba. Julia Swag, you raised the question of whether this is cracking down on reform or defending sovereignty or something in between the two. Listeners, you can join us as well. Why this big new Fidel crackdown? And why now? Does this sound like news from a different decade? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Castro's crackdown and the new struggle over Cuba. My guests are Gary Marks, Havana correspondent for the Chicago Tribune, joining us from Havana, Cuba. And joining us from outside Washington, Julia Swag, senior fellow and deputy director of the Latin America Studies Program at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of Inside the Cuban Revolution. You can join us as well. Despite all the resorts and tourism, is there still a life and death struggle going on between Washington and Fidel Castro's Havana? Why can't Cuba tolerate a little dissent, a little democracy? If Castro opens the door to reform, will the U.S. overwhelm his island? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Julie Swaga, I wanted to get your kind of bottom line here on whether this is crushing dissent or defending sovereignty. And I guess that's a politically loaded question when it comes to Cuba.
It's a great formulation, Tom, but I actually think it's both. Let me say before we get into the analysis that this crackdown and those executions are entirely unjustifiable and completely appalling and have scuttled major political and diplomatic capital around the world and in the United States, and particularly in the U.S. Congress. That said, and I think it's important to say it, I'll go back to your question. The political reform process in Cuba is barely underway, but over the last 6, 7, 8 years, there has been an opening of political space for these kinds of movements and organizations, and frankly, for broader discussion about what kind of Cuba and the national identity, what kind of Cuba ought to be, what kind of body politic it ought to become. You can see it in the state institutions. You can see it in culture and newspapers. You can see it all over the place. But
so why did Fidel's government open, and why now slamming the door?
Well, slamming the door now because I think it really does believe it may be up next for regime change, number one.
Seriously?
Yes, seriously.
I mean, we saw
Donald Rumsfeld the other day attempted to disabuse both the government, probably the individuals running Cuban affairs in the administration, the opposition, and portions of the Miami Cuban community that's not in the cards.
But we did see the U.S. ambassador to the Dominican Republic saying that war in Iraq is an example for Cuba to pay attention to. Was he off message?
Well, I think he was very much on message for the tone and inclination of individuals within the State Department running Latin America policy. I think he is off message when it comes to the grand strategists at the head table of American foreign policy who have greater strategic interests and understand that Cuba is not one of them.
So this heightened rhetoric is one element, but you had more to say about why now.
Well, I have more to say about why now, because I don't want to dismiss what I think is one of the major elements underneath this dynamic, which is that Cuba and the United States have a migration agreement. The two countries since 1994 have been committed to enforce it, and it has been largely and pretty well enforced since 1994.
That is, the U.S. doesn't want a flood of Cubans coming across.
The United States doesn't want a flood of Cubans, and Cuba does not want to face the wrath that it would undoubtedly experience if it could be targeted as the cause of allowing those agreements to falter. So the hijackings, it believes, were part of it, and I don't think this is correct, but it sees it as part of an interest, again, within sort of the most extremist view of how to handle Cuba within the U.S. government as a way to pin them with responsibility for doing something that would infringe on U.S. security, which, of course, a huge refugee flow would do, especially now that we're getting into a presidential campaign.
But we read this remarkable report, and Gary Marks, maybe you can speak to us about this, that the U.S. representative in Cuba, James Kaysen, went on Cuban television, first time that the U.S. rep has ever done that, to give some pretty stern warnings against hijacking and coming across illegally to the U.S.
Yeah, obviously, as Julia said, neither the U.S. nor Cuba wants a flood of refugees heading towards the United States. So, yeah, that was extraordinary that he did that. And in fact, I think Fidel Castro, sort of gave him a little kudo for that. But essentially, the relationship has really disintegrated, has gone downhill over the last 6 months, and it's just been extraordinary. I first arrived here in July, and you had the the incredible scene here of hundreds of American companies here at the first U.S. Agricultural Trade Fair, including Arthur Daniel Midlands and many of the largest companies in the U.S. here, hoping to increase trade, you know, just really, really hoping that this political opening and economic opening would continue. And then you've got essentially the door slamming shut right now. And as Julia said, I mean, there is absolutely no sentiment now in Congress to ease the travel ban here. And it's just the turnaround has been absolutely stunning. And everybody is asking the question, why? Why now?
Well, how, Gary Marks, how are you interpreting the turnaround from there? We heard supporters of dropping the long-standing trade embargo on Cuba, including Christopher Dodd, who's been a big supporter of getting rid of it, just spitting nails, furious about this crackdown. Where do you who's driving this seizing up of the relationship? Is it being driven by a hard line from Washington, by a hard line from Havana, a kind of a mirror where they're both toughening up? What?
You know, I think in many ways it's anybody's guess. It's clear that the Bush administration is taking a very hard line towards the Cuban government. I mean, President Bush has announced that. His representative here, James Kasin, has essentially stepped up the rhetoric here. His predecessor here, Vicky Huddleston, handed out hundreds of shortwave radios here, and she sort of stepped up the pressure as well. So I think clearly the policy is coming out of the White House. At the same time, you can make the same argument that who are these dissidents? These are several hundred people who are gathering signature. They have very little profile here, Tom. And
can I add
Cuba,
to that
they
also?
Are not covered. They're not covered on the local media here. People don't know a whole lot about them. So what threat do they actually represent to the Cuban government? So, I mean, it's very hard to say who's driving it. I really think the hardliners on both sides are driving it.
Julia Swag?
Yeah, no, I agree that this is a triumph for the hardliners in both countries, in Miami, Havana, and Washington, without a doubt. I also think that since as Tom's opening statement indicated, the Cubans had totally penetrated, as they always have for as long as I can remember, have penetrated these organizations with their own state security agents. So, you know, on the one hand, you could say that this crackdown is evidence of weakness and vulnerability. On the other hand, they're demonstrating in a sort of preemptive way that if the United States is intending to build a fifth column, sprinkle a few million dollars a year around the country to try to turn Cuba into the Poland of the 1980s and support the creation of a civil society, that they can thwart that. And that's, I think, a very strong signal that's been sent by this.
Julie Swig, are you suggesting in that Cuba is not capable of producing its own homegrown opposition movement to Fidel Castro, that it would only come about if it had American fingerprints on it?
No, not at all. I'm not suggesting that at all. But I am suggesting that to the extent that the United States tries to stick its fingers and its money in it, it will undermine such a process. And that time and time again, it has been shown that when the United States tries to play down there in an intrusive and in a way that's offensive to Cuba's national dignity, which, of course, as a historian I understand, is very, very strong, when the United States tries to do that, it backfires. And it backfires against people on the island, and it backfires against our policy and against many, many, many people who for different reasons, whether it's trade, national interests, because they like Cuban beaches, are inured of Cuba's art and culture, whatever you name it, or simply have a sort of libertarian commitment to Americans' right to travel, for whatever reason, it undermines all of those people interested in just dispensing with the embargo when Cuba cracks down. And so we're sort of in a vicious dynamic, and we're, you know, there's always been peaks and valleys in the relationship. I think we're below sea level at the moment.
Gary Marks, I'm struck by how much fuss has been swept up over the U.S. representative there, James Kasin. Fidel Castro called him a bully with diplomatic immunity. They're clearly following his every move. It reminds us, I guess, of what a relatively small place this is. But could you describe how long has he been there? Who is he? And how has his activity differed from his predecessors? Why has it caused such a storm in Fidel Castro's circle?
Well, he's a career Latin America hand, and he's been down here. I think he came here In the late fall, he replaced somebody named Vicky Huddleston, who's now, I think, the U.S. ambassador in West Africa and Mali. And essentially what he did is he came down here, as I recall, his first sort of public appearance was on the eve of this huge U.S. Agricultural trade fair down here. And he came here, and his first speech, as I recall, he called Cuba's economy a Jurassic Park economy, and essentially warned U.S. companies not to come down here and trade in Cuba and do business in Cuba, because essentially they would get stiffed by the Cuban government. So, you know, essentially he came down here with a very hard line. And like I said, the U.S. acts here differently than most other diplomats. Other diplomats here essentially meet with dissidents. They do it in a low-profile sort of way. Mm-hmm. You know, James Kaysen has come out here, and he's essentially met with dissidents openly. He spoke after a meeting with a dissident group publicly to the media, which I think really hasn't been done before, essentially saying that Castro was afraid of freedom, afraid of basic human rights. He also allowed dissident journalists to hold a meeting at the official U.S. residence here in Havana. I mean, these are things that really were without precedent, at least in the recent years.
Can I jump
in? That, I think, personally really got to Castro. And although nobody knows, you know, who actually made the decision to crack down, we can all assume it came from the very top of the government. And I think Kaysen essentially just, you know, pissed off the top people. And I think Fidel Castro probably said enough is enough.
Julie Zweig, give us a sense of how can one man have such an impact? Can James Kaysen appear life-threatening to Fidel Castro?
Huh. You have to ask, if they're so pissed at Kaysen, why didn't they just expel Kaysen from the country? But Gary, just to go back a little bit, I'm not so sure that Kaysen's obnoxiousness, as the Cubans saw it, was so unprecedented. Vicky Huddleston before him was just as intrusive, just as overt about assembling dissidents at her house. I mean, I've been in her house down there with dissidents there on a formal official visit with members from the United States that I was there with. This was done sort of routinely, and the Cuban government was well aware of it. Huddleston's arrival, I think, marks the turn in this. And frankly, you know, they can pin this on Kaysen, but they should have thrown him out if it was really only about Kaysen. I think that this all would have happened 6 to 9 months ago, has nothing to do with the Iraq war, but was put on pause in a sense because of September 11th. And it took some time for the United States to regroup after September 11th and really sort of our own crackdown in closing down some of travel and stopping and allowing many Cubans to come here with visas as we were doing before. There was a sort of a similar, not so parallel, but definitely a hardening in U.S. policy, as Gary indicates. But I think that would have come much earlier on and just didn't because of September 11th.
But it was a Bush administration kind of instinct. Julia Zweig, Gary Marks, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from New York City, Lucius Walker. He's director of the Interreligious Foundation for Community Organization, Pastors for Peace. Good evening and welcome, Lucius Walker.
Good evening, Tom. It's good to be with you again.
Thanks for joining us. Lucius Walker, your group has done a lot of work in Cuba. What's your sense of what's happening here? Has your group seen the dissident movement growing in Cuba? Do you agree with Gary Marks now that it's gutted? Do you have a political eye out on what's happening there?
Well, I'm taking a note of the fact that there has been what appears to many of us to be a deliberate effort on the part of the United States to increase the pressure, to up the ante, as it were. In 1995, there was an agreement reached between Cuba and the U.S. that 20,000, you know, exit visas would be granted by the U.S. interest section per year. Last year, that number was not reached. This year, to date, there have only been about 500 such.
But Lucius Walker,
to increase the pressure of people to try to, you know, go from the country illegally.
Why shouldn't the United States support a democratic movement in Cuba?
Well, supporting democratic movements is one thing, but actually aiding and abetting and flooding money to dissident groups, on the one hand, while preventing the possibility of legal, normal immigration, on the other hand, is not just aiding change, but really it's an effort to put a stranglehold on Cuba, it would appear to us. So we think the question that we ought to be asking is not, well, along with the question, why has Cuba cracked down, we ought to be asking, why has the U.S. deliberately and openly used its diplomatic staff and massive financial resources to organize, finance, and promote dissent within Cuba?
But isn't there real domestic dissent? I mean, the Varela Project, the petition that was talked about openly by Jimmy Carter when he was in Cuba last year speaking to the Cuban people. It's signed by 11,000 Cubans asking for a more open government. Does that qualify as genuine domestic non-interventionist dissent in Cuba?
Some would say so. But the fact is that Cuba has not appeared, in my view, to be threatened by the Varela Project. They don't like it, but I don't think they've been threatened by it. And it's very interesting that Peña was not arrested. He was one of the people who was not arrested. I think he has been open and even-handed in his criticism of Cuba. He has not apparently been on the payroll of the interest section, but in any case, I think his being free to continue to do whatever he does is an indication that Cuba can stand dissent.
Though we're hearing a different interpretation of that tonight from Julia Swag. Lucius Walker, we've got a bad line, but I want to thank you for joining us, however briefly there. Lucius Walker is director of the Interreligious Foundation for Community Organization Pastors for Peace. Pat's calling from Menominee, Wisconsin. Hi, Pat. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Cuba's always been a real question in my mind. I've never really understood the relationship with this country. We've got Guantanamo Bay there. We've got military there. Castro's always been a big pain in our keister. What's been the relationship? What's kept us from just taking his guy out?
Well, the United States, of course, tried and failed. Are you suggesting that the United States should, as you say, take him out? I mean, is that our job to do?
We just did it in Iraq.
Well, there's an indicator of public mood. Pat, thanks for calling. I'll put it to you, Julia Swag. Do you see a kind of mounting sentiment like this, that if the United States does such things in Iraq, the United States might do them in Cuba?
Well, we've certainly laid a precedent for that, but I don't think that Cuba is Iraq. I don't think that this administration regards the two countries as having anything like a similar strategic value. But I think surely Fidel Castro would anticipate a point of view such as the caller's to become more prevalent. However, that said, we tried to take Fidel Castro out several times with several hundred assassination attempts, invasion, covert operations. One of the reasons that we failed is because Fidel Castro does not rule by repression alone. In fact, there remain, although it is less so in my eyes today than last month, continuing sources of legitimacy there. And that might be unpleasant to hear, but it's true.
Julia Swag, Gary Marks, stand by. We're talking about Castro's crackdown and the new struggle over Cuba. Why the big new crackdown? Why now? And who benefits from the unending standoff over Cuba? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Castro's crackdown and the new old struggle over Cuba. You can join the conversation. If Castro opens the door to reform, will the U.S. overwhelm his island? And despite all the resorts and tourism, is there still a life-and-death struggle going on between Washington and Havana? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight, Julia Swag, Senior Fellow and Deputy Director of Latin American Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. And joining us from Havana, Cuba, Gary Marks, Havana correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. Gary Marks, Lucius Walker was just with us before the break and talking about the U.S. throwing bundles of cash at political dissidents in Cuba. Is that your sense there, that it's really there's so much U.S. support for the political activist movement there, the reform movement there? How do you see that?
I absolutely don't believe that, and I think that, you know, I think that clearly the U.S. government is supporting the dissidents, as I mentioned, through by funding the websites, by giving them fax machines, by giving them computers. But the idea that these guys are walking around with bundles of cash, I think it's just absurd, and I think it's a gross exaggeration. These essentially are mom-and-pop operations, and these independent journalists, these independent librarians and stuff, essentially are just, like I said, mom-and-pop operations who, without the support of the U.S., it'd be hard to figure out how these people would survive, because a dissident here really usually loses their job. And so it's a real catch-22. Yes, by taking money from the U.S., they are essentially setting themselves up for being arrested. But if they don't take money from the U.S., who else is going to support them?
And Gary Marks, how about the awareness among ordinary Cubans of what's going on with the hijackings and with the political trials? Is it known across the country? Does everybody know it? Is it big news? Is Fidel making a big example of these people?
Well, it's interesting. The dissidents have been covered essentially, in the official media. Essentially, they're basically portrayed as being agents of the U.S. government, on the payroll of the U.S. government. So the dissidents have, you know, people don't have a huge knowledge of what these people are up to. The hijackings essentially stunned people here. The executions really stunned people here. That was announced officially over Cuban state radio and Cuban television, and people took notice. You know, the idea that people would be executed for carrying out a hijacking in which nobody was injured really sent a strong message to people that, you know, you better not hijack a plane or a boat here. You're going to end up dead. So people took notice of that, and I think it really did harken back to some time period that people really here haven't felt in a long while.
Julius Swag, there's so much about this that feels like a throwback. We've seen just in recent months polls coming out of Miami showing the Cuban exile community in Miami with a much more kind of moderate view, at least in the polls, of what's going on in Cuba, seeing that the sort of center of political dissent ought to be shifted back to Cuba, let it happen there rather than just being cooked up in Miami. And suddenly here we are with this very old-fashioned kind of crackdown and exchange of claims and counterclaims. Where is this relationship headed between the United States and Cuba?
Well, I think it's going to continue to stay frozen or freeze over more. You know, before this last month or so, we had on the one hand an economic and an unofficial opening, mm-hmm. and on the other hand a hardening of the ideological and rhetoric and the official ties between the two countries. And that divergence was growing and growing and growing, and clearly was unsustainable both from Cuba's perspective and really, frankly, from the United States' perspective. I think that the White House really dreaded the moment when President Bush would get an appropriations bill on his desk that might have some amendment attached to it that stripped large portions of the embargo away, where he would be forced to either veto or sign a bill that could alienate very, very important voters in an election season in the state of Florida, very important financial donors in an election season in the state of Florida.
So in that sense, Castro may have done President Bush a political favor.
One could make that case very much so. Very much so. And so then you have to go back to the question of, well, why did Castro calculate that he wasn't going to get, that it wasn't in his interest any longer to tolerate the open dissent, to tolerate the sprinkling of cash around, and to sit on his hands and allow it to happen? Why was it no longer in his interest? I think he calculated that after Iraq, especially, the United States going into a presidential campaign, the move in Congress was not going to get any further than it had gotten, that the White House had already sent out a veto signal once, that the administration was starting to clip the wings of some of the openings along travel that had begun, and that it really needed to be shown and demonstrated very clearly that he would draw the line and between sovereignty and reform, choose sovereignty. They'd call it national security.
So losing hope there that the embargo might be dropped in any case. Lawrence is on the line. Hi, Lawrence. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just listening to the last person that was talking, I think that's true. I originally hail from Miami, and I think the older Cuban immigrants that live in Miami right now, they're very against, I think, taking away the embargo.
Mm-hmm.
And commenting on the comments made by the pastor from the Interreligious Center, I really think that there is no space for dissent in Cuba. I have a second cousin right now on the island that is currently under arrest, that was arrested less than a month ago for dissenting.
Do you know exactly what your cousin did, Lawrence, to gain that arrest?
He was voicing his views aloud, and that's something that is not tolerable over there. I mean, there's people in just, you know, your neighbor could be a spy for the government and you don't know it. So people will keep their comments to themselves. Even though they don't agree with the government, they won't say that. They'll say that they do agree with the government, because if they publicly announce their rejection of Castro's ideology, they'll lose their jobs. If any property that they may have, they'll lose it.
Lawrence, we've got it, and thanks very much for your call. Vidya is on the line. Hi, Vidya, you're on the air. Oh, looks like we lost Vidya. Gary Marks, let me put Lawrence's point to you. At this point, after these arrests and very tough sentences, is there any room for political dissent in Cuba?
Well, people can complain about the economic situation here. They can complain generally about the situation here. But I think the caller's point is generally on target. You can't point fingers at certain individuals in the government. You can't openly go out on the street, hold up a sign, and protest against the government. If you do that, you're going to be arrested. This is a police state. And as Julia said, Castro has legitimacy. He's done a lot of things. He does have a certain level of support here. But the bottom line is, this is a one-party state. And anything that challenges the preeminence of that one party will get you into a lot of trouble. So the caller is generally correct.
Julie Swiger, our time is running down, but I think there was a kind of assumption that began to grow out of the looser travel restrictions and the new images and pictures coming out of Cuba, that one way or another, however slowly and softly, there might be a velvet revolution underway here, that there would be a kind of a gradual reform or modification in Cuba. Was that ever a real dream? Is it real? Is it alive at all now?
Oh, I think it was very much alive. I think especially, for example, you mentioned Senator Dodd, and especially a lot of the Democrats in the House and Senate, and also in the Republican Party, and sort of many Americans, the many that have gone in the last few years. I think that there was a feeling that never sort of connecting the dots directly, but as the United States and Cuba could relax tensions and open up society to society and economy to economy, that would then soften the edges inside of Cuba, remove the sense of external threat, and allow Cuba's body politic to grow and breathe without the threat that clearly a tough economic sanctions program like this one creates, and also remove the outside pretext for the domestic crackdown. So I think many of us, myself included, felt that there was a relationship between a bilateral opening and an opening on the island.
And now all that in the deep freeze. Julia Swag, it's been great having you. We're out of time, but thanks so much for coming on tonight.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed myself.
Julia Swag is Senior Fellow and Deputy Director of the Latin American Studies Project at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of Inside the Cuban Revolution. And Gary Marks in Havana, Cuba, wonderful to have you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom. It was great.
Gary Marks is Havana correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. In a moment, a Yellowstone Park ranger blows the whistle on poaching and loses his post. This is On Point. Bob Jackson has worked for 30 years at Yellowstone National Park, but he'll be out of a job this summer. He says it's because he blew the whistle on a serious wildlife problem at the park. According to Jackson, hunters are using salt blocks to lure elk and other wildlife outside the park so they can hunt them. The discarded carcasses are then drawing bears out where they are being shot by justifiably frightened humans. In this radio diary, Bob Jackson explains why making the media aware of this problem cost him his job, and why all he wants is to be able to return to work in the most remote area of the continental United States.
Everybody sees Yellowstone from the roads. Most of the people, you know, they'll see the geysers, they'll see the wildlife along the roads. But as far as like a lot of the alpine meadows, you know, the high mountains, you know, the sheer cliffs and the big valleys with the meandering Yellowstone going through it, those are the areas of the backcountry that the people don't get to see. And that's where I patrol out of. It is the most remote area in the lower 48. And I just think it's such an opportunity that very few people, and I just thank my lucky stars that I get to experience something like that, that normally would have been something probably someone would have had 100, 150 years ago. As the years went by in the backcountry, Yellowstone, which I'd always specialized in catching poachers, I started realizing that the animals of Yellowstone were being drawn out. My concern in Yellowstone was there was a lot more elk being killed right outside the boundary of Yellowstone, and which meant a lot more gut piles. And the bears of Yellowstone were leaving the park in a lot more numbers each year, and you'd see tracks every day coming out of the park going on to these gut piles. One fall, we had 8 grizzly bears killed in my area alone by hunters that were coming into confrontations with those bears that were trying to eat all the meat that the hunters and the guides were leaving. In other words, the hunters and outfitters were making nuisance bears, and then they were justified in killing those bears. When we started having the problems, I started writing reports on it. One of those reports got leaked to the press by someone, and the press started asking questions. After the press started asking questions, the Park Service thought, Yellowstone did, that they wanted to make statements about this, which in the end was minimizing the problem. And the press picked it up right away that they were trying to hush this thing up of what was going on in the backcountry of Yellowstone. And their alarm, the press and the public, of why Yellowstone, one that was supposed to be protecting the resources, wasn't trying to protect it. After they had problems of keeping the press out from talking to me, they put a gag order on me, saying that I couldn't talk about any issues in Yellowstone, anything having to do with my job, whether I was working or not. And so finally, I was told this spring that I wouldn't have a job. If employees feel that they cannot say what they feel or what they see or what they research, and if we can't, as an example for our government, allow people to say what they believe, then what are we heading to? What are we going to? I mean, yes, we're not going to go to a dictatorship like was over in Iraq, but at the same time, it's kind of scary to think that people do want to limit your speech. Just because there's different opinions, I mean, I don't feel I'm wrong, but even if I was, I should be able to express that. And if people see that I can't express that with all this publicity, then they're going to have to worry about whether or not they can. They're going to have to be fearful for their jobs.
Bob Jackson is a buffalo rancher and worked as a park ranger for Yellowstone National Park for 30 years. He's currently lobbying to get his job back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.